Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. Welcome everyone to another episode of the Damage Report. I am John Idrola and it is Wednesday, of course. I'm sure you're aware of that. So you should also be aware that Jared Jackson is joining me in studio today.
Some people don't know that it's Wednesday. Gotta be honest with you. Once you see that it's JR Wednesday, then you realize.
Exactly. So you're here and I'm glad that you're here because we not only have a lot of news, obviously, and two awesome guests coming up, which I'll tell you about. We also have a story that I very much want you in particular to be here for. And it is the Ben Sass, Sean Hannity Sass Fest. We're going to be talking about a little bit later on the show. Senator Ben Sass has some critical words for partisan media. He probably would not be a fan of me, but in particular, he's attacking the right, which makes it even more interesting. And Sean Hannity is not buying it.
Is there something about the pettiness that you think I enjoy?
I don't know. I just thought there's a Sean Hannity and them going back and forth.
No, it's okay. You can say it.
Yes,
no,
I
enjoy
it was the pettiness.
Yeah.
It was the pettiness.
Absolutely.
Okay. So, yes, there's a bit of pettiness. We're going to be starting off, though. We're going to be profiling the grand scheme that is the Republican Party playing out in real time, as predicted. We'll be telling you about that. Later on in the show, though, I have been wanting to talk about a mass shooting, which is a terrible thing to have to say, for several days now, and we have not gotten to it. I'm hoping to a little bit later on today. And then later on, rapper T.I. featured a Melania Trump lookalike in a recent video. Melania Trump's people are now striking back. Do they have a point? We'll be talking about that a little bit later on as well. But starting off with the GOP plan. So we told you in advance of Republicans getting control of the White House and keeping control of everything else that this was going to play out in a very particular and predictable way. And the idea is always the same. Massive tax cuts that drive up the deficit, which justifies major cuts to progressive priorities, which doesn't actually fix the problem, and the deficits remain high, the national debt continues going up, and then a Democrat has to get into office and has to fix the whole thing by not prioritizing the funding of any progressive programs later on. We're not all the way through that process yet, but we are getting there, because this week the Treasury reported that the 2018 deficit has swelled to $779 billion. That level, the highest in 6 years, marks a 17% increase over 2017. So, very often recently, Donald Trump has said, I've accomplished more in 2 years than many other presidents have. And look, in his less than 2 years, he's beaten one whole term of Obama on the deficits. Mm-hmm. And so, it's really weird because, you know, like they passed these huge tax cuts earlier this year. And we were saying at the time, that's obviously going to raise the deficit. And in fact, we had the CBO was agreeing with us, saying it would add $1.9 trillion of national debt over the next decade. In fact, a loss of government revenue bigger than that caused by the Great Recession. But we were like the only people talking about the possible effect on the deficit. There were people striking back from the other side. People like Steve Mnuchin saying not only will this tax plan pay for itself, but it will pay down debt. So it will lower the deficit, lower the debt. Donald Trump has been saying things like that for literally years. So it's weird that we were right, huh?
It's
how that works out.
There's so many other drivers to it too, because there's also the part of it being, and I think this also was happening today. Mitch McConnell again was going after the three drivers of our debt. He was going after debt more specifically.
We're gonna play the video actually.
Oh, okay, sorry.
We're gonna play the video.
But the point is being they want to go after these other things and they put these in place, but they keep missing where they contributed to it. And it's not like who could have seen it coming.
Are they missing it?
But as I'm saying, it's not like who could have saw it coming the way it was with the Iraq War and that administration. Mm-hmm. It was more of hey, we know what we're doing, but we can convince enough people, and obviously we're paying our debts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ironically, back to the people who got us and paid us to get in office to do these things. It's just we have to stretch out long enough, which is what they're doing when they passed the tax plan, stretch out long enough to convince enough people who don't know what's going on mm-hmm. to go with us with this. Who cares if later everything gets destroyed? Because they're just going to assume the next Congress or the next administration that comes in, it's their fault
when
everything gets destroyed.
And phase one is cut taxes. Phase two is deficit skyrockets. Now we move on to phase three, as we laid out in the intro to this video, and it is perfectly summed up by Mitch McConnell.
Very disturbing, and it's driven by the three big entitlement programs that are very popular, Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid. That's 70% of what we spend every year. The subject we were just discussing, the funding of the government, is about 30% of what we spent. There's been a bipartisan reluctance to tackle entitlement changes because of the popularity of those programs. Hopefully, at some point here, we'll get serious about this. We haven't been yet.
So what Mitch McConnell is saying is what you were alluding to. Mitch McConnell is saying that the reason that this deficit is going up is out-of-control spending on things like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And so it will now be the job of responsible politicians to look into cutting those programs. So get ready for that. He's not the only one. Paul Ryan, who has literally never talked about anything other than cutting those programs Absolutely. In his entire life, said that entitlement reform, as he calls it, will continue in 2019. So they, the one nice thing here, the one very polite thing that the GOP is doing is they're making it crystal clear to every one of you out there that if Republicans maintain control of the House and the Senate, they are going to massively cut these programs as much as they possibly can to help pay for the tax cuts that they've already done and to help justify paying for tax cuts that they plan to cast or plan to pay do after the midterm election. So that is coming up. You know exactly what the stakes are in these midterm elections. They are going out there and enthusiastically screaming at you on CNBC and programs like that.
Yeah, who is you? But he said, now you guys understand it. They're Hopefully not convinced ever. That people understand it. So much so that they will blatantly come forward and say, yeah, you know what? We have this horrible debt. The deficit keeps, it's worse every year we do it. So now, in the meantime, let's give more tax cuts and then tell you that it's going to change it all. And then when it doesn't, just say, you know, it's your fault. It's those entitlement programs that you're not entitled to anymore, that you didn't pay into somehow. Mm-hmm. Somehow that's now the problem, when it's obvious that the original problem was they're doing. They're reading the American people's understanding of how this works. Mm-hmm. And they're like, they don't understand it. We can say and do whatever we want. And enough of them will go, okay, because all they've sold to us is that Democrats are bad with the economy and Democrats are bad with money. They don't know what they're doing, but Republicans are good with money. Republicans know what they're doing with your defense. Republicans know how to keep you safe. All these things that are absolutely unfair and have been proven out to be false, mm-hmm. somehow they can still convince enough people that that's just the way it is because yeah. that's what we told you for long enough and we'll continue down the same road.
Yeah.
Republicans, you guys have told me how much the tax cuts rescue the economy and rescue mm-hmm. our everything that's happening financially in the country. How are these magical tax cuts going to help build up the problems with this deficit now then? I mean, because is it only the entitlements? Mm-hmm. How many more times will the tax cuts fill in these holes that you keep creating?
Yeah, well, obviously it's done the opposite. They said that it would pay for itself or be revenue neutral. Instead, it's surprising everyone, the deficits have gone up. He said there, these entitlement programs are 70% of what we spend. Yeah, they're big. We do spend a lot of them. And we did last year. And we did the year before that. Why are the deficits skyrocketing now? The constant is these programs. The new variable are the tax cuts you chose to put forward. Thus, it is probably the tax cuts, not the spending on those programs, which is historically similar as it has been for year after year after year after year.
Think about it. We tell the American people, you're the best humans in the world. You're superior than anyone else. You mm-hmm. deserve the best. You are the best. But when we want what we've paid for, suddenly we're not worthy of it anymore. You don't deserve those entitlements. You know how much mm-hmm. we spend on your ass?
Yeah.
Yeah. The amount that I spend on my ass. That's how much I spend for it. That's how much I deserve back for it. It's amazing how you can keep telling people, you don't deserve it, but you're the best in the world. Which one is it? Do we not deserve it? Or are we the best in the world?
Yeah. Yeah, and we understand what this is all about. They want to pretend that they're just being fiscally responsible, and they're the ones finally going to tackle these big problems. They acknowledge, by the way, that they are popular. So hopefully them being so obvious in their desire to attack those will play into enthusiasm on the opposite side on these midterms. But the reason that they want to attack these programs is because proportionally for the people that they actually want to deliver for, the wealthy in America, they don't care about these programs. It's not to say that a wealthy person doesn't use Social Security. Everybody does. But they don't need it the way the poor and working class do. They certainly don't need Medicare and Medicaid the way that the poor and working class do. They're okay with taking care of themselves in those things. They don't want to be funding those programs. If they can pillage from there, to pay for another round of tax cuts. That is a way better economic deal for the wealthy, certainly for corporations as well. So expect more sustained attacks against those programs, especially if Republicans are able to maintain control of both houses of Congress in these midterm elections. We are now going to take our first break. When we come back, we're going to be profiling an awesome documentary, Transformer, with one of the stars in studio live after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Welcome back to the Damage Report, everybody. I'm very excited right now to profile another awesome upcoming documentary. It is a Transformer, and we're very lucky to have the subject of that documentary, Jhené Krzyzewski, in studio with us right now. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you here. So we're going to play a clip from the trailer in just a second, but if you could sort of set it up, you are the subject of this documentary. It is profiling a very emotionally charged, important period of your life. What is the premise? How did this come about?
Okay, so the film basically follows the two and a half years after I was outed publicly as transgender, which I'd already been out to my family and friends, but then I was outed publicly by a YouTube blogger and basically turned my life upside down. So you see everything that goes on in the 2 years following that.
Yeah. I have to say, as I was reading about this, as a person who primarily works on YouTube, that really is one of the dark parts of YouTube, is the sort of thriving on drama and trying to create an issue. Like, obviously that's an incredibly personal thing for anybody, especially someone with the profile that you have. To choose to do that for another person is really reprehensible. That said, I do want to give people an idea of what they can see in the documentary, so here's a clip from Transformer.
I don't think I'm comfortable as an extremely muscular woman, but as a guy, that's the only way I'm comfortable.
Let's go, man. Come on. Oh, geez.
Oh, there's just this feeling of being pulled between two worlds. How am I ever going to find peace being comfortable in my own skin?
So there's so much I want to ask you from this documentary, but I want to start off, you mentioned that you had already been out to your family earlier, before the public outing. In the documentary, there are interviews with different parts of your family, both your parents, your kids as well. Tell me about that.
Well, as you see, I have a really good relationship with my sons, which I think is a very important part of the documentary. We're very close, and I told them early on when they were very young, 2, 4, and 6. So they've grown up knowing all their lives, and they're very supportive and very comfortable with everything. And I think you really get to see the special bond that we have in the film. But then my parents, on the other hand, even though they've known for over a decade now, are still having a really hard time with it. And you see that in the documentary as well, that they, you know, my mom talks about it as if I have died. And I mean, some of the stuff was a little tough for me to hear because she never really wanted to talk about it before. So some of the things she said was the first time I heard her saying those things.
Yeah.
And but yeah, my parents still struggle with it. They're from a small town, and it's very difficult for them.
Yeah. And it is possible that your experience is sort of emblematic of a generational shift in, you know, public awareness of the community and the issues that it faces and things like that. You know, I'm sort of jumping ahead. You say later on in the documentary, as you're talking about some potential surgeries and things like that, that these are not, like, people talk about them as cosmetic surgeries, but you describe them as life-saving surgeries.
Yeah.
And how the struggles you've gone through, what might make it worth it for the next generation? Could you talk about those issues?
Yeah. Well, first of all, the surgeries are, you know, it's not cosmetic in the way that someone's doing them merely to improve their appearance or, you know, look better to other people. For us, for transgender people, it's to help us feel comfortable in our own skin. It's to help the inside match the outside. And that's really what it boils down to. And, you know, so that's, it's a different perception a lot of people have of like plastic surgeries and things like that. And, so yeah, it really can be life-saving because it's for someone that doesn't feel that way, that's comfortable in their own body, it's really hard to describe and really hard to relate to. But I mean, the only thing, you know, the old adage of take your, you know, if I could take your brain out, put it in the body of a woman and then tell you, okay, now try to be okay with that.
Yeah.
No matter what you do, you're never going to feel comfortable. So that's why these things are so important for people like me.
Yeah. And that exact analogy you just gave makes so much sense. But for a significant portion of the country, they just cannot seem to put themselves in that place.
Yeah. Especially for the older generations, the thing is there's been such a stigma and in such a negative way that the older generations, everyone was closeted and everyone was hidden. People were terrified to come out, as I was for most of my life.
Yeah.
I knew how I felt by the time I was 5 or 6 years old, but I also knew coming out to even my parents wasn't going to be okay and wasn't going to be received well.
Yeah.
So I grew up the first half of my life, you know, feeling all this guilt and shame for feeling this way and not understanding why and being terrified if anyone ever found out.
Yeah.
And, so for the older generations, they don't think that trans people even existed. But the fact is, we've always been there. It's just been too dangerous and too much stigma for people to ever come out. At least that all that stuff's finally changing.
Actually, I want to talk to you about that because in the documentary, you talk about one of the benefits of retaining your size that you have from powerlifting is the fear of a negative reaction, possibly even a violent reaction. And I read in an interview about at one point people had followed you nearly to your car. So talk to me about that, about this fear. Does that ever go away? Do you?
I don't know if it'll ever go away. I mean, it hasn't for me. I don't like feeling vulnerable, and that's probably one of the things that motivated me to want to get so big and strong. I mean, I always had a passion for strength training and really enjoyed competing, but it also gives you a measure of protection, and it helps me not feel vulnerable. And the incident you mentioned, one night I had 5 guys follow me into a parking garage late at night, and I wasn't even aware that they were there until I got to my car and got in, and they were right next to me and kind of doing the mean mug thing, and I could tell they were contemplating whether or not to try and jump me, and I think the only thing that stopped them was my size.
Yeah. Yeah, just absolutely horrible. I wonder the unwillingness or the inability of the older generation, and honestly, a significant part of my generation, and probably this is not something that's simply going to go away in 10 years. I wonder if it's wrapped up in this sort of, at times, ridiculous conversation about masculinity we're having in this country.
For sure.
Just yesterday, I saw Piers Morgan attacking Daniel Craig for having his kid in, like, strapped to his chest. Like, there's this incredible fragility and fear in a lot of American masculinity. And I wonder if your experience is sort of a threat to that, or it makes them think about themselves in ways that makes them feel uncomfortable?
Sure. Yeah, and I think me especially so, especially because I come from this background of being an ex-Marine, of being, you know, world champion powerlifter. And my reputation wasn't just one of a powerlifter. It was, I was known as the alpha male of the alpha males. Mm-hmm. And so, and I think a lot of people that respected me for the things I achieved and the toughness I displayed, you know, it really made them reconsider everything when I came out and, you know, as trans. And people find that threatening to their masculinity, and that's a lot of times why violence is provoked. And you know, we live in this heteronormative society too, where masculinity and heterosexuality are held at the top, and anything threatening to that makes people very uncomfortable.
Yeah. So one of the things that sort of one of the major threads throughout the documentary is about you wanting to feel more comfortable in your skin in a number of different ways. At the same time, your, like, not hobby, your main passion and career has been powerlifting and producing this particular body, and sort of some of the friction between those two things. You have a conversation with some of your weightlifting partners about what you could do with your body if you wanted to, but there's this sort of like this tension between those two things. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, well, like a lot of women, I felt a lot of pressure that if I was going to transition and I'm going to live my life as a female, that I need to be this small, you know, tiny girl that we see so much in the ads and in the media. And initially, I dropped 72 pounds in 4 months, and I had planned to drop well over 100 pounds. But after I lost a bunch of weight and started losing so much strength and size that I had worked so hard for, I started having all these conflicting emotions. You know, I was frustrated. Like any athlete, no athlete wants to get weaker, slower, mm-hmm. and, you know, all those kinds of things. And it wasn't until I got closer to the women in the strength training community and realized they struggle with the exact same things. They want to get bigger. They want to get stronger, but they're constantly being told, oh, you look like a man. Why would you want to do that? That's terrible. Oh, I think you look gross.
Yeah.
And so it's all this pressure from, you know, even our friends and family to not do these things, even though we find them very empowering and you know, very beneficial to our lives.
So you mentioned the weightlifting community there. In general, when you were initially outed and over time, what has the reaction been like?
I would say it's been 50-50. You know, so there's been actually a lot of support. And I knew I was out to a lot of the elite level powerlifters and some of my sponsors. And I knew they would support me as well as my close family and friends. But there was actually a lot of support from the powerlifting communities and especially the women's side of the sport. And that was something I was really concerned about. I didn't know how they would view me, if they would see me as a threat or an imposter or something like that. But they've actually been really supportive and embraced me, which I've been very thankful for. But then, of course, there was a lot of the hate that you would expect, ignorant comments and hateful things. And I still get them, but, the thing I try to keep in mind is when someone says something terrible about me, I try to remember it says more about them than it does about me.
Yeah. And their fears and insecurities.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Honestly, 50-50 is, that's better than I would have expected.
It was better than I expected, to be honest.
Probably really, really rough.
Yeah.
Amidst everything else, including one of the things you talk about in the documentary is the various things that you've had to sacrifice and fears about losing your job, going for another job. Obviously, there's an incredible amount of workplace discrimination against the trans community. Mm-hmm. What has that been like?
Well, fortunately, I'm back working as a pharmacist again, but it was much more difficult. I applied for probably 50 positions before I even got an interview, which in the past that never would have happened.
Yeah.
And in some of the positions I was very well qualified for and never even got a phone call or anything.
Yeah.
So it's definitely, you know, and as out as I am now and with, you know, social media, all anyone has to do is Google my name and they'll find out everything. So mm-hmm. I can only assume that played a large role in it.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely for out trans people, it's much tougher with employment and discrimination and things like that.
I imagine. Even though you're a vet as well. Like,
yeah,
that's supposed to make it a little bit easier in general.
You would think so.
You would think.
Yeah.
So obviously still a lot of progress that needs to be made. Obviously the documentary, Transformer, which is out in, I believe, 25 cities mm-hmm. this Friday, is about your personal struggle, but it's in the context of a community at large that really needs to improve. So thank you so much, Janae, for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's great to
see your documentary and to talk to you about it.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break. We come back. Jared is going to return to us. We'll be breaking down Senator Ben Sasse's criticism of what he calls politicainment after this. Welcome back to The Damage Report, everybody. Jared Jackson back at the desk. I want to talk now about media, right-wing media, and the criticism of it coming from the right wing. Senator Ben Sasse, who has occasionally been vocally critical of Donald Trump, which in terms of actual action has amounted to nearly nothing, but he has been willing to criticize him. And now he has a book coming out. This is Them, Why We Hate Each Other and How to Heal by Ben Sasse, where he criticizes the media, which seems to, I think, understandably get that the way to make money is to attack the other side, whether it's accurate or reflects reality or whatever. But what's interesting is that he attacks right-wing media as well, and in particular Fox News, and in particular, Sean Hannity. So it's really awesome. He says that the core objective of the two different programs that Sean Hannity has, it's not to promote a particular conservative agenda or to encourage American patriotism or even to offer coherent arguments against liberalism. His core cause is to rage. And he described most Hannity storylines as liberals are evil, you're a victim, and you should be furious, which is both 100% true and a more concise version of that argument than I have ever made myself. So thank you, Ben Sasse, for that. I want to read a little bit more, though. He says, this is a quote from the book, Hannity tells a lot of angry, isolated people what they want to hear, and he has the delivery down to an art form. We'd all be better off, as would our communities, if we understood the game he and his colleagues on both sides of the spectrum are playing. And there's going to be more that we're going to say, but that is 100% spot on. Angry, isolated people, just take a look at them, figure out what they want to hear, and just say it to them over and over and over again. And that is enough to get you rich and to make you famous. And Sean Hannity and others have discovered that. And Ben Sasse, willing to if not actually vote in a way that, you know, stops the powerful people like this, you know, from advancing, is at least criticizing
them. It's an art form. And here's the thing. Everything that Ben Sasse is saying is, of course, not new. It's not undiscovered from folks that look at it closely like we do. And more specifically, I have to a lot of times because I have to watch a lot of these guys.
Mm-hmm. And I do a lot.
Yeah. And I have to, and there's a point when I predict what they're going to say. This guy, too. When I'm listening to some of their opening monologues or their rants, I'm like, and then I'll fill in the blank before they get there. Mm-hmm. I'll tell them where they're going because it's the same thing over and over again. It's like you know, there's some TV shows have a storyline that follows. Okay, let's put Family Guy there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Family Guy, every episode has a beginning and it ends in the whole storyline each half hour. Sometimes there's reoccurring characters and stuff, but it starts and it ends right there. It's kind of the way they work. So, except this is with news and then opinion-based news stuff. So when Sean Hannity goes in and talks about whatever, he starts and it ends it. And then the next day, he doesn't have to have any kind of connection to that last reality. He just starts it again. A lot of times it is repetitive, but he doesn't have to have any kind of responsibility to continue the story with any kind of fluidity.
We have an example of that. I'm going to skip ahead one graphic. And so Ben Sasse was talking about the Las Vegas shooting and Hannity's coverage of it. So early on when these sorts of shootings happen, there's often disinformation. Either people have found the wrong profile or there's just 4chan decides, you know, we're just going to make up a bunch of stuff. And so that happened in this case. And there was a fake Twitter activity saying that this person that had done the shooting was hoping to kill mainly Trump supporters. That was not actually true, but that is the story that Hannity ran. Uh-huh. And so here is what Ben Sasse says. Having given his millions of viewers the impression that Trump supporters were killed and that liberals cheered it on, he moved on. It was a grotesque distortion of reality. It was quite literally fake news. And so what he's saying there is Hannity did not even briefly say, oh, by the way, that major report we did yesterday and focused on and raged on wasn't actually true. He just moved on. As you said, it's the episode's over. We move on to the next victim complex and rage and all that.
Absolutely. It's crazy. I wasn't even fully like confident in saying that I would predict everything they said because I've done it my 5 to 6 times. I was like, oh, I knew he was going to say that. And I said it first.
Yeah.
I love it that it was just confirmed. I had no idea that was part of Ben Sasse's his book. But it's exactly what it is. It moves right along. And then so all you're left with is feeling that rage and that anger and that victimhood and going, yeah, I hate liberals. And then in your show the next day, you have he feeds you a new plate of hate.
Yeah. Yeah. And the angry isolated is exactly true. That is the perfect audience to try to tell these people, I am the only one you can trust. Everyone else is lying to you. Listen to me. I'll speak honestly. What they mean is, I know exactly what you want to hear and I will give it to you. And that is a reliable thing. You can come back every day. As you said, there's no evolution. Nothing ever progresses. There's never a call to actually do anything. Just consume what I yell at you and give me money in return. a show like Hannity, that is exactly what they do. And there's others on Fox News trying to imitate that. He's perhaps the best, but that's what Rush Limbaugh has been doing for absolutely years. And as Ben Sasse says, this is not something that only exists on the right. Anybody can technically do this if they find an isolated, angry community. And I will say, for this show, God help me if I ever become popular amongst a bunch of people who are unproductively just mad and isolated. We profile candidates because we want you to get out there and help them. We profile organizations so that you can get involved. We want to give you hope. Yes, we profile the major challenges facing this country, but we also try to give you a reason to hope and things you can actually do to change it. We don't want to have every episode wrap up cleanly and then start up the next time. We're supposed to be moving towards something productive. And that hopefully will set shows like this apart from ideologues, whether on the right or the left.
I like it.
And now, just a little bit more from Ben Sasse, because I also want to get to Sean Hannity's response. But Ben Sasse said, the incentive structure in the media complex rewards pushing the gas, not tapping the brakes or qualifying a point. Celebrities, political big shots, and media outlets have junior staffers constantly tweeting and posting, giving readers new reasons to click, and the sharper tongued the post, the better. So that gets into how Twitter plays into this awesome thing that we've set up here. By the way, if there was a button, it was like just on the wall, and you could press it and Twitter was deleted, I would be running at that button so fast. As long as it's here, I have to do it for career purposes and all that, and occasionally it's fun. But if I could press a shiny red button and shut down the whole thing, I'd do it instantly.
Don't you like seeing what some folks have to say?
Yeah, some.
If it was still at the base level of people, like, honestly just say what's on their mind, or maybe they show an experience, that's fun. That's the fun part of social media, seeing people, other people's experiences that you maybe wouldn't have seen. You know, you can see
some.
what whoever, your favorite celebrity is doing. You're like, oh, that's cool.
Some, yeah. Yeah, I think you should have to be a person to be on there. That would be an improvement. It's not the only improvement needed, but that would be one. So in response, Sean Hannity said a lot, but part of it was, unfortunately, I went to bat for Ben Sasse, who has proven to be the single biggest disappointment in politics today. He totally conned me, like he conned the people of Nebraska. He says it's the biggest mistake he ever made was supporting Ben Sasse. Really? That's the biggest mistake you've ever made? He doesn't actually rebut the points. He doesn't say, no, I'm not trying to stoke rage and isolation and things like that. Because he knows, like, Sean Hannity is kind of a dumb guy, but he's smart enough to know what his strategy is. He just doesn't like that Ben Sasse is laying it out as clearly as he has.
Again, more of the over-the-top hyperbole. So your biggest disappointment wasn't supporting the previous two administrations ago in the Iraq War in 2003? Mm-hmm. Was it supporting that? Like, unequivocally, and then finding out how bad that actually turned out. You don't regret that part of it. You regret supporting Ben Sasse because he exposed you in a book.
Mm, that's a weird thing to say is your main mistake. And he could do better. And can I say one other thing? So one of my frustrations in media that's developed over the past year or so is I have noticed, and I'm sure many other people who create content have noticed, there's a big difference between what people say they want and what actually does well. That's the main problem. So people will very frequently say, just talk about the issues. And not like a particular instance of the issue, but tell us about the issues. So do a video about minimum wage or universal basic income or methane or whatever. And we do that. But those videos don't do well.
Absolutely.
They never, ever do well. And I have come to realize why. And it's not as simple as they're boring. Yeah, that's part of the problem. But why is it that even the people who say they want that don't watch those? It's because I don't think they actually mean, I want you to make that so I can watch it. Those people are pretty sure that they already know about those issues. They don't need to watch an explainer about minimum wage. They get minimum wage. They're politically sophisticated. They want us to do it so that other people will hopefully watch it. But those people don't even watch it either. So we're going to continue to do that because that's our obligation, our responsibility, and also our privilege to have the platform where we can do that. But while we're doing that, just talking about drama between media personalities and endlessly challenging people debates, that's what actually gets views on YouTube, and that is frustrating.
I'm sorry, I hate to stretch this further, but it's the way we are as lazy Americans. Yeah, we're dumb. It's like I have a 6-year-old kid, you know, he wants to eat his food so he can hurry up and get to dessert. Mm-hmm. And then so if the broccoli's there, he'll have 2 pieces of broccoli. He's like, yeah, I had some, right? So if you watch the first 30 seconds of a video about the details, about the tax plan, you go, yeah, they're talking about tax plan. I just glossed over the broccoli's nasty. Can I have the cake, please?
Yeah.
And so you turn on the fights on cable news between two guys who are fighting over whether or not which side is evil. That's the cake. And we indulge in that and we get fat. And then eventually you stop eating the broccoli and all you do is eat all the cake.
Yeah.
And then we look and we're dumb. Sorry.
I feel like this is a critique of Sean Hannity and also a critique of my diet. Like, I don't think it's really as much of a metaphor as he's implying it is. I think he knows that I literally had a big slice of chocolate cake 2 days ago at work for lunch when I have a bag of broccoli in the freezer.
Dude, admit this worldwide, pancakes are breakfast food.
You know
what the tail end of that word is?
Cake.
Cakes. We have cake for breakfast and we give it to people and go, hey, here's a nice round breakfast for you in the shape of a circle.
Mm-hmm.
Cakes.
The amazing thing about pancakes on the one hand and cakes on the other hand is that we don't even pour syrup on cake, but we pour it on pancakes. That's crazy. And delicious. Okay, we do have to take a break, though. As much as I'd like to talk more about this, we have to take a break. When we come back, I want to profile a particular mass shooting that has not received a lot of national news coverage for a reason that's sort of understandable, but I'm going to break down why it matters. And then rapper T.I. takes a shot at Melania and Donald Trump. We'll be talking about that as well on the other side of this. Welcome back to the show, everyone. So I want to turn now to gun violence. Earlier this week, actually over the weekend, but earlier this week, the news broke that in a small town of Taft near Corpus Christi in Texas, there was a gunfight in America, that broke out between two families at a birthday party. It was a birthday party for a 1-year-old, and as a result of that, Four people ended up dying, and one ended up in a critical condition. Since then, they have actually tracked down one of the surviving members of this fight. Ronnie Rodriguez has been arrested. His father, Ronnie Sr., is still being sought, at least as of yesterday. I guess families that get in gunfights together, stay together, or something like that. But here's why I want to talk about that. So this is a one-year-old's birthday party. There's multiple families there. When you look at the list of the dead, it's like, I think, three brothers and like a 62-year-old got shot and killed. Absolutely devastating. Any mass shooting is devastating. The way we talk about gun violence, though, and the need for guns, and when a gun would be useful and when it wouldn't. Well, you know, what if like I'm there and somebody's like robbing a store? I want to have my gun and I want to do this. But we so rarely talk about what does it mean to just have guns around? So there's a one-year-old's birthday party. This is in Texas. Many people in Texas keep guns in their cars, something like that. I'm going to assume that that's what happened. I'm assuming they weren't literally strapped, you know, or whatever. It was in their cars, something.
Probably shouldn't assume
that. It was accessible.
That,
yeah, that's true.
I got you, but we'll go with that.
Either way, it's accessible. So they start this verbal altercation. It turns to violence. Why are four people dead? Because they got in a fight? No, because they got in a fight and guns were nearby. If there weren't the guns, this exact same situation, does anyone actually believe that what would have happened is at this one-year-old's birthday party, four people would be dead as a result of people killing each other with their bare hands? That they would have begun grappling with each other until they had broken the necks or bashed in the faces of four people? No, it takes a gun, the easy, casual killing weapon that requires little thought, no effort whatsoever. You pull a trigger and a person is dead. It's very easy. You can pull it. You can shoot a person in a split second. Actually killing a person with your bare hands, far harder. Far fewer people could actually do that. But in a state like Texas that has some of the most gun-friendly laws in the entire country, let open carry rights for individuals 18 and older, as long as you take a safety course and have a permit, so easy to transfer guns and all that, the background checks are a laughingstock in comparison to a lot of the other parts of the country, that this is the sort of situation where multiple people are dead only because it is easy to have a gun. Everything else becomes extraneous at that point.
And it's the easy solution, as we talked about before. To have to actually do something and work through anything, say a problem, say an argument, say a fight, it's too much work. We're lazy. Mm-hmm. So it was really easy to squeeze the trigger and point it at someone, especially when you're upset or scared. John was just watching some world star hip hop fight during the during the break, right? And it was this guy was double teamed by two guys. He was a big guy. He ended up taking them both down. If anyone in that situation had a gun, while those two guys who lost the fight were being slammed on the ground, guess what they would have done? Because they're afraid. They're like, oh my God, this guy's about to drive me into the ground. They were lying there on the ground for a few seconds. But you know what they kept doing? Breathing.
Yeah.
So it ends up going down. And the guy who won the fight, he's still around. And it's all over. Yeah, you had some embarrassment. So it's the perfect storm as Americans of being embarrassed, afraid, and wanting this quick solution. So hand me this gun. It can solve all of my problems.
Yeah.
And it happens all the time, don't think about the consequences that are involved after that.
Yeah, so many situations, it could have just been a person getting punched in the face. How many fist fights end in a person being killed? Not a lot. But when there's a gun, suddenly it becomes a lot easier.
It's real easy.
Okay, I want to turn very quickly to something very different. So the rapper T.I. released a video, sort of a promotional commercial video, and I want to show you just a little bit of it.
Melania Trump did not go to Mar-a-Lago with the president this weekend, which has a lot of people wondering.
So that was tweeted out earlier this week by T.I. with the accompanying statement, "Dear 45, I ain't Kanye." And obviously the spokespeople for Melania Trump, who's depicted there, not happy about this, calling for a boycott of T.I. What do you think?
Well, I mean, all of the Trump fans and Melania fans that had just had T.I.'s album in the checkout on their iTunes, they were like, man, I was on this, man. I was ready to listen to more. I was going to add it to the rest of my T.I. collection until this thing came out. It's
But okay, that's totally true. Eric Trump is not suddenly snapping all of his TI albums. should he have done it?
Yeah, he can do whatever he wants. And the thing is, it's distasteful. It's disrespectful. Yeah, they did it to Michelle Obama and all that stuff. Except it wasn't. It's not. There's an irony to it. He puts it in people's faces. It gives people an opportunity to show their hypocrisy. So yeah, I wouldn't do it. But that's me. I'm not going to tell anybody else what not to do. But it gives people a chance to look at it and go, oh man, I hate this. And then so you can say, how does that feel? Because before you really didn't care.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, Melania is the most bullied person in the world. Remember that?
And she says
she's
that,
the most bullied person in the world, except your husband just called the woman he had an affair with a horse face.
Yeah.
I haven't heard you on that yet. Yeah. If liberals have to be split down the middle to make sure that they're pure on every side, let's not have this argument with someone who's not willing to take that same purity test.
That's it. I would like that argument a little bit more if it was just a thing he made rather than a thing he made to sell albums. That's the thing.
Oh.
So look, I wouldn't have done it. I am in the business of telling people what to do or what not to do. So please don't do that. Of course you can. You can do whatever you want. You're an artist. You can do anything you want. I wouldn't like if it was Michelle Obama. So right. I don't really love this either. He's an artist. He can do whatever he wants, but I probably wouldn't have. Okay, we're going to take a break. When we come back, congressional candidate Kara Eastman is going to be joining us, breaking down the current state of her race. She actually just had a debate in the past 24 hours. We'll be talking a little bit about that on the other side of this break. Very excited to welcome another awesome candidate to the Damage Report. Today we have Kara Eastman, a Democratic congressional nominee for the Nebraska's 2nd District race. Kara, welcome to the show. We're very excited to have you here. Don Bacon, which I believe is the correct pronunciation of his name.
I don't know.
I'm not really sure. So you're running against him. You had a debate against him just yesterday, was it?
Last night, yep.
Oh, so how did that go?
It was great. It was really fun. We have some very clear differences of opinion and policy perspectives, and I think those were laid out in a really good way.
Well, let's talk about that. What do you see as being the most consequential distinctions between yourself and Don Bacon?
Honestly, I think that his voting record stands on its own. He's voted almost 100% with his own party and with the president, and that does not represent Nebraska's values, let alone America's values, and also his allegiance to corporate America. He's taken a lot of money from corporate PACs, whereas I've taken none, and he stands up for those companies. He stands up for big pharma, for insurance companies, for big tobacco, for the NRA, and I'm somebody who's going to stand up and fight for the people.
We could certainly use more of that. So there's a number of congressional races people have high hopes for in areas where Trump won, in some cases, pretty decisively. Now, in this particular district, he won by just 2 points. So considering that and the fact that Don Bacon is relatively new to this seat, how do you feel about your chances going in just a few weeks from the midterms?
Well, we've never been complacent, despite the fact that we felt like we had an edge. And there's just so much momentum. I think if you came to the district, you would see that my signs are everywhere. Mm-hmm. It looks like I own the district. And there's just a lot of enthusiasm about the campaign and a candidate like myself. And the momentum that we're seeing is just, it's actually pretty overwhelming and exciting. But I'm just really proud of everything we've accomplished. We've run a great campaign. And in the end, I think we're going to pull this off and show America that even in Nebraska, we can run on a pragmatic but progressive platform.
And so, of course, you're focused, as you should be, on your particular race, the particular dynamics of your district. But obviously, there's this meta-narrative about, is there going to be a shift in control of Congress? Is there going to be a blue wave? Do you find that type of talk to be productive or helpful? Or do you worry about the possibility of sort of apathy being inculcated through that?
I think we should always worry about apathy. I mean, if we look at the 2016 election, I think that was one of the results. And so for me, the most important thing is getting out, talking to voters, encouraging them to vote. I think it's actually kind of difficult to earn somebody's vote these days. People don't trust politicians. They're frustrated with the political system. They see all these negative attack ads about me and they don't like it. It's not very Nebraska. So I think the most important thing right now is just getting out and talking to voters and showing them that they have something they can vote for and not just against.
Yeah, and I agree. It is difficult when these campaigns go low. I see that on your social media, you've been great at responding to these dishonest attack ads. You're tweeting out rebuttals and things like that. Hopefully, people will see through a bit of that. I mean, our politics has gotten so dark recently that your type of campaign, which is focused on particular issues, actually being responsive to the voters, very necessary. Unfortunately, we don't have much time. Hopefully, we can have you back, talk a little bit more about some of the issues you're pushing for. So, Cara, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. So unfortunately, that is it. We have to go. But thank you for joining us. Coming up later this week, we have got a bunch of awesome guests. They're going to be both Skyping in. Also, this Friday, an amazing in-studio co-host for myself. A little surprise for you. I'll leave it at that. But tune in later on this week. We'll have all that for you and more. Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.